Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We are a network of tech founders, investors, and connectors, and our aim is to support startups on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this since 2003. We're active across Australia. We've got over 5,000 members. So if you're interested in joining us, please check us out and sign up as a member at innovationbay.com. Now, if you like this podcast, and we really hope you do, please do tell the world about us on social media. And if you're feeling super generous, you could also rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. We love hearing your feedback, so please do let us know how we're doing and who else you might like to hear on the show. Today on the show, I do a deep dive with Matt Allen. Matt is one of Australia's best and most prolific angel investors. You'll hear a little bit more about his track record and what he's done, but it's pretty amazing. Matt and I actually worked together for a couple of years, about 2 years ago, at AWS. He was the second person to join my team at AWS. We had a ton of fun together. I mean, the key thing that I was looking for in that role and in that team generally was startup passion. And Matt epitomized that. I mean, if you cut Matt, he would bleed startup. He knows more and cares more about startups than just about anyone I've ever met. Matt had a fascinating journey. He was a self-taught developer, didn't go to uni. He became a recruiter. He's, as I said before, angel investor. He was at AWS for a while. And now he's launched a new thing, Tractor Ventures. You wouldn't call it venture capital, but you'd probably call it venture debt. So it's a pretty interesting new entry into that area. And we get into some of the detail there. He's doing that alongside his wife, April. And I've actually just hired Jody Imam as well to join them as their COO. So Jody was ex-Springboard. And again, the three of them are a terrific team. And yeah, look, it's going to be good what they're doing. All right, look, let's jump over to the show and hear from Matt. And I hope you enjoy it. All right, welcome. We are here with Matt Allen. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
Great to see you. We're actually sitting in an office in Sydney, which is a little unusual.
Face to face.
Are we 1.5 meters away?
At least.
We should measure it.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're in InQtel's office. So thanks to the InQtel guys. They're the US, agency's venture capital arm. So there's even a co-investment that you've done with them. And
there is.
Yeah.
Yes. They sit on the cap table with me at Casada.
Yeah. Anyway, look, Matt, you are pretty well known in the startup, sector. You and I know each other pretty well. We worked together for a couple of years at AWS. That was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, I saw you cry once at the top of a mountain.
I do remember that. You drove up there very slowly. I think we advertised it as, hey, come for a holiday in Hawaii. And the reality was drive very slowly up a volcano behind two middle-aged crazy men.
There was more brake than accelerator that day.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. So we'll get into the AWS journey. Let me maybe just give a little bit of an overview, because for those that don't know you, you do have a bit of a reputation and track record as an angel investor, really. So, I mean, this came from John Henderson at Airtree was doing a blog series on the best angel investors, and you were number one with April, who we'll talk about in a sec. So 533,000 invested into 26 companies over 7 years. That's gone up a little bit, hasn't it, since then? $2.6 million of cash returned from that. So 610,000 from exits, 1.9 million, which is a pretty huge number in secondary sales. And that was more than one secondary, or there was one major one in there?
Yeah, there was three in there.
Three in there. And then 35K in dividends. Wow, what's a dividend in the startup world? 58% of your portfolio have a female founder. So that's amazing. Three of them have gone bust. But if you aggregate the remaining holdings, you've got $7.7 million of net value on paper, which is what, 19 or 20 times the original investment.
Yep.
So that's amazing. I mean, this is why you're on the show here. It's that you've done an astonishing job. Portfolio includes BuildKite, Practice Ignition, Spaceship, Casada, we mentioned Dunsafe, Pin, and Gotera. Olympia's been on the show. So, yeah, look, when you hear that stuff, any observations on the journey? I mean, 7 years is quite a long time to be doing this, but you must feel pretty happy about that.
Pretty happy about that, but also kind of lonely as an angel investor. You know, 7 years ago, there wasn't a hell of a lot of people doing a hell of a lot of things. And, you know, it started off by a sign of got this strange transition from being a tech guy that was really interested in business. I think I was a reluctant tech guy for 15 years and wrote a lot of code and It worked well. It made a lot of people a lot of money, but I really was more interested in the high-level business stuff. And the way that April and I got our start is we made a pretty significant bet on Xero, the accounting platform.
When it was listed or before that?
It was on day one of the listing.
Right.
When a dual listing on the ASX. So it had been on the New Zealand Stock Exchange for a long time, and then they did a dual listing. And at that point in time, when I was still a developer, I'd done a lot of work in the Xero ecosystem.
Yep.
And I talk about like the business I ran before Xero or didn't do very well, and the ones that I've run since Xero have been fantastic. So it was a life-changing piece of software for me as a business operator.
Yep.
And, you know, people say you should invest in things that you understand, and very infrequently do you get the option to, you know, buy a publicly listed company, you know, when it debuts and you already have a deep understanding of what it does. So we kind of slid a lot of the chips across the table on that day and held on tight, and got to a point where I think it was quite, you know, went in at $5, it got up to $40. And April suggested that maybe we take some of those returns and diversify a little bit and take some and put it into some more, shall we say, boring things. Stable was the word she used. Boring was what I used. I also negotiated that I could take some of that money and put it into startups. So
yeah, because, I mean, investing in, I mean, Xero as a listed stock, I mean, it's, I don't know what number you'd put on it, 1,000 times easier than investing in the cap table of a startup as an angel investor.
Yeah, it's certainly easier. There's a, you know, a trading platform you put buy, and as long as the price you put on is less, you know, is greater than the one that's selling it, someone will probably buy it, sell them to you.
And you're, it's fully liquid. I mean, if you want your money back, you sell it and you get something. I mean, it's a very different proposition.
Very different.
I mean, I guess the way you think about it, I mean, I think the way you were talking there about how you thought about Xero was very similar. Mm. But the reality is very different. So yeah, interested in how you jumped onto that, but we should probably just touch on April. So April's your wife.
Yes.
You've been married quite a long time.
You've got 19 years.
19 years. So great work. That's an achievement. Let's talk about her. So she is passionate about startups as you are now.
Now, yes. I think initially, especially 7 or 8 years ago when our kids were, you know, much younger, she was very much an operator, you know, operating the family and operating her business and her, you know, the job that she was working in. You know, and I guess there's an element of, you know, financial trust in a lot of this stuff. It's, I had the understanding. I think this is what we should do. And interestingly enough, she would tell you that I'm quite, financially conservative. So, the line that she tells people when she answers, like, Matt would never do anything to jeopardize our personal situation, and all the things we've done they may look spontaneous, but they're not.
Right.
So, you know, the amount of time I spent in the Xero ecosystem, you know, I had built a platform called Practice Ignition as the last thing I coded as a professional software developer, and sort of being deep inside that ecosystem. So when I said, hey, this is going to happen, you know, this is going to become, we're going to have the ability to buy some of this company that I've dealt so much with over the last period of time. She was like, okay, that sounds like you know stuff. Why don't you do that? And, you know, I always say in public companies, you don't get the option to see inside them very often. And I hadn't seen inside them. I'd only seen it from the API layer out, but being able to speak to the team over there and understand where they're going with this thing was really important. And then, you know, on the private side of things, you know, understanding about these companies and what they do is kind of fun. So back to your question about April, she's passionate. Recently has become more so. So had been quite passive for the first 5 or 6 years. Started to lead a few investments in Mentor Loop and Harvard, and her background is in IT operations and financial operations. So very much a sort of knowledge and operations perspective. So there's a few things that popped up and she's like, I understand that one. I want to do that one. I'm like, please do. You know, I don't have a monopoly on good ideas here. And recently she did the VC Catalyst course out of Uni Melbourne. And that was really interesting because it allows you to, instead of just osmosising up the stuff that I talk about and getting my point of view, she kind of learned the lingo and learned the structure around some of the stuff that I do. And I obviously over-index on some things and under-index on others. And now I think she has a much broader view of the investing landscape and the words to go along with it. And I find this is an interesting thing about people starting off on their journeys of anything is until you have the frameworks of what to do it and the words to have an intelligent conversation with someone, and like feeling like a dumbass holds you back from doing a lot of stuff. Yeah. So she's just gone crazy lately, which is excellent.
And so how would you summarize the skill mix between you?
So in our current portfolio, she's definitely on the sort of portfolio nurturing side. And I've done a lot of the lead generation and, you know, the deal stuff. You know, her specific skill set is around knowledge management, scaling of customer support and customer success teams. So, you know, as the companies get bigger, she can certainly help them optimize that. She has very much has a bias for the things that she likes, which is, you know, knowledge management, tools to help operators, you know, in the sales and success, sorry, in the success sort of, and support teams be very efficient. You know, those, especially customer success, you know, it is the face of your digital company. And they don't have a lot of tooling around a lot of the time. They don't, you know, they're kind of like low paid, you know, high churn workers a lot of the time. And so she's very passionate about that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit more about the angel investing. I mean, that's really what you're best known for here. And, you know, I think we've had the adverts and the podcast. I mean, Innovation Bay is launching Horizon, which is going to be a club for angel investors. And, you know, we're hoping that you and April might sign up. But we've been pushing it to a few people, and there was one, I'm not going to name names, but they're a very wealthy property person. And then when I sent the spiel over to them, they replied with this email. I'll just quote it. He said, given that startup is the highest rate stage for a business, I'm interpreting your Horizon concept as a means of ripping up money while suffering under a very time-consuming cold shower. Now, I thought that was one, kind of rude, and two, load of bullshit. So, any thoughts or comments on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm on record of saying that, you know, from a financial perspective, you know, the minute I write that check, it's kind of gone. Like, I just don't think about it anymore.
You mean from a mental perspective?
From a mental perspective. Right. Oh, no, from, you know, like, it's gone. It's not like I'm sitting there waiting for it to do something. You know, I think the best thing you can do as an angel investor, in fact, the thing you should do as an angel investor is not write the check and forget about it. You should write the check and understand how you can help that person. You know, we talk about smart money and we talk about dumb money. The worst you can be is annoying money.
yeah.
So like that is the worst thing you can do for a founder. So either write the check and reply to every update and say nice things.
Yeah.
Better still, reply to every update. And when they ask for stuff, like over-index on helping. The worst thing you want to do is being annoying. So annoying consists of asking stupid questions about the future that they can't possibly answer. And the most annoying thing is not signing documentation when they're trying to get stuff done.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a fair comment. Yeah, you know, Gelix Invest is a syndicate, and we often talk to the founders that are coming in about this one-way filter. You know, you want all the good things, as you just touched on, you know, the introductions, the advice, the expansion opportunities, all that stuff, but you want to filter out the bullshit. So, you know, why is that update 2 days late? And, you know, where are you going with this? And that's pretty key. Any other secrets? I mean, because a lot of angel investors out there, and this is part of what we're, you know, trying to encourage with this asset class, it's, you know, a little bit tricky to access, and adding value can be tricky. Mm. I mean, like, you know, you and I have got good networks and we've been around startups for a long time. So I think there's a way of helping that others might not. But is there a formula for helping if you don't have those deep networks and experience?
Yeah, I like to think that everybody's an expert in something, right? Yeah. And that something, you know, may or may not be relevant to this startup, and it may or may not be relevant right now. But it could be that you've, you know, by the time you have the capability, the financial capability to angel invest, it's highly likely that you've had some experience in some domains. And, you know, as I meet a lot of new angel investors and they say, where do I get started? I'm like, if you look through the lens of the things that you like and you get excited about, and go and find founders who are in a similar space, you should be able to have a conversation with them about relevant things, you know. You know, so angel investors can be very thematic. They're like, I only do stuff, you know, I'm a real estate person, therefore I like real estate tech. And the reason being is I can hopefully have a conversation with them about a topic I understand. Or they can be generic, or, you know, widespread where they have an open mind and anybody with a good idea, they can have a conversation about. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, how you perceive your skill set. You know, are you a generalist? Are you a business person? Have you run multiple businesses and the businesses you ran were problems that you solved that sort of popped on your radar?
Yep.
Or are you, you know, have you been eyebrows deep in the same thing for 15 years and that's what you like to talk about?
But is Australia big enough for a sector focus?
I mean, if you're an angel investor who's writing a handful of checks or a couple of checks a year, then sure, you know, like it's, you should be able to find a couple. And, you know, I always encourage angel investors to write, you know, smaller checks more often just so you can get your eye in and you realize what's important to understand at that level and what's not important to understand. And, you know, the most frustrating thing for a founder raising an early check is talking about things that are irrelevant right now. It's time consuming, you know, it's frustrating for them because they probably don't have the answers and it makes you look like a bit of a dumbass.
Yeah. So in terms of getting started, I mean, this is one of the things we, as an angel investor, this is one of the things we're thinking about in terms of trying to encourage and get people more focused on it. Any tips? So, you know, people out there, they might have, pick a number, $500,000 to $10 million of investable cash and they're, you know, thinking about this as an asset class. What's the best way for them to get started?
I think the best way to get started is to join a syndicate that can, you know, that has really good deal flow. And, you know, I'm pretty transparent about being involved in plenty of syndicates. You know, you don't have to align yourself with one.
Yep.
And, you know, your job is to watch the deals go by and grab onto the ones that appeal to you. You don't have to do all of them. I would also, you know, those numbers you mentioned are a lot of money. I don't think you need that much money to start angel investing. Yep. Like you can write $10,000 checks into angel syndicates. You know, as long as you tick the high net worth box, you can write small checks. And that's what I suggest. My first check exited this year and, the founder called me and said, hey, we're exiting. We're, you know, getting acquired. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I get to get my $15,000 back. And he went, you put 50 in. And I'm like, oh, I forgot. I haven't written, like I've written very few checks of that size ever since. So right. It's like you get excited at the beginning and the problem you need to overcome as an investor is, hesitating if you write a check that's too big relative to the entire pool you've got to allocate, you'll overthink a bunch of stuff and you'll only, cause you know, it's a bit like, oh, I don't have enough information. You're never going to have enough information. So my recommendation is turn the volume down on dollars so that when you go here, take 10 grand or here, take, you know, pick a number and stick with it and do a year's worth of that.
Yeah.
And spread it around, you know, find the syndicate leads you like, you know, whether it's Geelix or Eleanor or 1013 or Scale or whoever. There's plenty out there now. And the people who run these things are out there trying to find the best deals. So, you know, you get to, it's kind of like putting your chips behind someone else's hand in Vegas. It's like, you know, if they're playing well, double down.
Yeah. I think your comment around, you know, you're writing the check and you're assuming that it's gone is the right one. I mean, we had a similar story with Store Reduce, which is our first investment that we made, you know, so 3.5 years later, it was an exit and we had to phone the investors to tell them. There was 12 people in our first, this is the very first syndicate we'd done. Out of the 12, three of them had forgotten that they'd written the check.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, are you phoning me to tell me it's gone? It's like, no, we're going to add a zero to it. I mean, it was a 10X on all of them. So that was a nice phone call to have. But many people who are investing this kind of, they don't, you know, it's set and forget for many of them. Mm-hmm. So that's great advice about how to get started. Once you've got started, like any advice on how to be successful. So, I mean, like your portfolio there is astonishing, probably the best out there from what I can tell. How did you do that?
A lot of the question comes down to like, how do you make your decisions? And then what do you do next? Yeah. So my decisions are quite, there's not a series of tick boxes that everyone needs to get to. There's some sort of arbitrary trust threshold I have with these founders. It takes a bit of time. Like there's very few checks I've written that were fast ones. Kind of getting to know people and getting to understand how they operate is sort of on the way in. Once you're in, there's almost no reason as an angel investor to not be 100% supportive and 100% kind to these people. Like it's hard work. And it's an uphill battle every day. So, you know, if you're at the point where you can, you've got enough capital to angel invest, I'm going to make some assumptions around the kind of lifestyle you live. You should be able to reach out to them. You know, I proactively send everyone every now and then when they pop into my head, say, hey, how you going? Do you want to go have a beer? I end up being, you know, obviously I've got some pretty good business advice and strategy to help with them. And, but ultimately it's making them feel like you've got their back.
Yeah.
You know, your capital sort of gets you on the cap table, but your kindness will get them telling them that anyone who comes to them and say, like, who invested in you? Can you connect me with someone who's going to help me? Like that, or if you're the first person they think of, that gets you some pretty cool deal flow. And that's, you know, that's happened multiple times.
Yeah.
Happens all the time. It's, in fact, it's a very hard flywheel to stop once it started.
But in terms of making that initial decision, I mean, you must see, I'm guessing like 300 or 400, maybe less, 200 companies for every one you invest in.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the key factors? So maybe for the founders out there and they want to get investment from Matt Allen, like what do you want to see in a founder or a startup before you put your cash behind it?
Yeah, it's, I have a strong bias for founders who have felt the problem rather than observed the problem.
Right.
So I think that framework's really interesting. So, you know, you get 3 or 4 pitches a year of uni students that want to solve parking at uni. And I just want to stab myself in the eye. I'm like, this problem is, it's probably a real problem, but you're not going to, like, the longevity of your ability to solve this is zero. Like, nobody cares. And then the founders, you know, I would suggest our average age of founder is in their 40s because they've lived the problems and the ability to articulate the nuances around why they're solving it that way doesn't come when you do a bunch of surveys on a problem you think might exist because you walked past, you casually observed it.
Yep.
So there's that. If you mention the word blockchain, I won't reply to email. So I don't know if that was helpful, but that's kind of where.
But because there's normally a few factors that go into the successful business. I mean, the three main ones are, you know, the founding team, like who are the founders? And, you know, to your point, are they solving a real pain point in their life? And have they done it before? And, you know, how good do you think they're going to be?
Yep.
You know, if you punch them in the face, are they going to get back up or go back to the corporate job? I mean, that's kind of what we think about. The second one is the market. You know, what market are they in? Is it global? Is it big? Is it hard to get into? Are the barriers around it? And then the third one is the strength of the product. You know, is the product good and does it look nice and do customers love it? I mean, how do you think about those three?
Well, I strongly over-index on the people.
Right.
In fact, I've invested in plenty of people where I don't even jump into the product very much. And do I trust the people?
Right.
Kind of it. You know, a lot of people think Matt's a, you know, software developer and has led teams and built out teams and, you know, so therefore must jump into the code and make sure the product. The only thing that's constant are the people.
Yeah.
Even the market changes because, you know, the market as defined on the way in is not generally the market you get to on the way out, on the way through even. And the product is a constant variable. It varies all the time.
Yeah.
So if you trust the people to be able to ask good questions and then respond to maybe some inputs that you can give them, and on the way in, there'll be a lot of that. Have you thought about this? Maybe you should try that. Come back to me. You know, go and learn a little bit more about this and tell me what's going on. And that cycle, you know, the amount of people that I ask a question to and then you never hear from them again is a really nice filter.
Yeah. And just before we move on, like, have you seen any great blockchain companies?
No.
Why is that? Like, why was that so overhyped? I mean, it's definitely died down a little bit, but you're still seeing it now and again.
Yeah. Look, two things for me. One, the signal to noise ratio is just so far out of whack that I don't have the brain space to dig into it. So it's a personal thing for me. Second of all, you know, the technology behind it is just inefficient, right? It's terrible for the environment. Like, it's just like cracking codes to solve this problem. And the distributed nature of it, you know, it can always be solved with normal technology. And the upside of, like, we have a ledger that's spread around all these, you know, fast machines in warehouses places you go to Quantum Ledger at Amazon and go, you do realize that like a hosted managed service by Amazon is solves 99% of those problems. And the things you think are a problem in this particular instance aren't even a problem.
Yeah. No, I'm with you in that. I haven't seen any great examples either. And there, look, there appears to be, if it's a pure blockchain company, there's a sort of swagger and arrogance and, you know, the founders tend to be, I don't know. And I don't want to
use criticize them.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
That's how like most of them come across. And that's the problem. So yeah. I don't have the time to feel, to even decipher which ones are which. It sucks because if it's a good technology, I'm going to be on the wrong side of it. And I'm okay to be that at this particular point in time.
Yeah. All right. Look, I want to talk about Traktor. So Traktor is your new, vehicle for investing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about that. How did that come about? And what is it?
Yeah. So, really exciting. So, my time at Amazon, where we spent time together, had me meeting lots and lots of founders. As mentioned earlier, I've been involved in venture. I was a scout for Blackbird. You know, I have a lot of, you know, venture style investments. But, you know, venture is two things. It's a group of people that I, you know, I call my friends and I love having robust discussions with them about all kinds of stuff. But in reality, it's a financial model that has some extremely, important and relevant inputs and outputs that if you don't qualify, you shouldn't take venture. So, you know, I love venture. I am, you know, I'm an LP in several funds. I think venture is excellent for the companies that are venture backable. But we found that there's a funding gap. There's a bunch of founders who are building, you know, high margin technology companies who do not want to put their company in a state that requires the growth that venture requires. It's not to say they're any less ambitious. It's not to say they can't do it. They just don't want to. And, you know, you and I know several of these companies that match that criteria. Yep. And I think that there's a growing cohort. So there's two sorts of two cohorts of founders that sort of fit that criteria. One are founders who have been involved in venture before and just don't want to do it again. So there could be second time founders that are like, I don't want to do that. And the other one are people who are running companies that are growing at a rate that is good, but not, you know, the investors can't see a straight line to $100 million revenue. Or the time frames could be a little long, or, you know, it's almost a bit of like, you could see a line to 5 or 10 million of revenue, but it gets a bit foggy after that and they can't quite, you know, see that through. And, you know, a lot of founders spend a lot of time, you know, pitching to VCs and trying to shoehorn their business into a model where they can get the alignment and get the check. So, based on all of that, and based on the founders that I like to have in my life, is that I like people who can solve a problem, charge for it because it's creating real value, you know, really focus on their team and customers. And don't want to really rush at a bazillion miles an hour. Not to say they go slow. Nobody's going slow, but they just don't want to rush. They don't want to compromise some of the things that you've generally got to compromise once you take venture.
Yeah, so what would they be? Like, which compromise do you think?
A lot of the time it's compromising on, you know, so the aim of venture is to grow. Like growth is the metric and growth comes at a cost of, you know, can you treat your customers exactly as you want to treat them? You know, can you help them achieve their success on their timeline rather than trying to force them to do a bunch of stuff? Do you have to compromise on team? You know, you've got to get somewhere fast. You've got 18 months of runway. We've got to get there really quickly. You know, and I've got to go out and hire 20 people. Like quite often you see it, right?
Yep.
It's like you drop the hiring bar and you and I worked at Amazon. We know what happens when that happens. It doesn't work out well. So, for a venture-backed company, for the good ones, time is their friend because it creates this forcing function to go really quickly. And if things go really, really well, then that's exciting.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of them. We know that 9 out of 10 venture-backed companies don't get to the, you know, escape velocity of the rockets. And that's quite confronting for me. You know, you've got to remember there's also 9 teams attached to those and 9 founders and 9 teams behind them that are in this state of not awesome. So we thought we could create a vehicle and some products to help those founders. So Traktor Ventures believe that secure founders run better businesses. And we see ourselves as a Traktor and a product company ourselves. We are an investment company. We're not a fund. So we have permanent capital. We don't have an end game. Our end game is to, create money, recycle it, put it back to work again and keep going. So our first product is revenue-based investment, which is a combination of two things. Revenue-based finance, which is capital deployed and returned via a small revenue share until upfront agreed multiple is returned with some mechanisms.
So it's basically a lender. I mean, it's
basically a loan
that
floats with your MRR. So if you have a low month, it goes down. If you have a high month, it goes up, but it's just a flat 5% with an upfront holiday, so you don't have to start paying it back straight away.
So when you say flat 5%, I mean, is that the interest rate or?
No, that's not the interest rate.
Didn't think so.
You pay it, but so upfront, we determine how much capital you want.
Yeah.
What is the multiple? How many times are you going to return that? So somewhere between 2 and 3. You go down a little bit lower for like really, really mature companies, but so it's a multiple on that. And then the 5% is of your monthly revenue.
I gotcha.
We'll share 5%. Yep. So 5% of your gross rev pays back that. There's a mechanism there that if you pay back more, it can come back faster, effectively reducing the interest you have to pay. So we're trying to make it as founder first as possible.
How long are the loans for?
It depends.
Okay.
So the variable is time.
Yeah.
So it's not a fixed time. It's a fixed percentage of your monthly revenue and is a fixed multiple on the capital.
Yeah.
So it varies. So if you grow quickly, it comes back quickly. If you grow slow, it comes slow. So, back to our belief that secure founders build better businesses, we believe that this type of capital allows them to grow at the rate that they want to grow it. And our business model can, they can grow slow or they can grow fast and it works well for us. That's fine. The other component of that first product is that we have some earned equity. So we earn a very small percentage of equity over the first 12 months of that deal. And for that, you get unlimited access to our team. We have a shared Slack channel. We have 5 extremely experienced operators who lean in and help you do whatever you want as strategy and advice. So the revenue-based finance component is how we generate revenue for Tractor and how we generate revenue to run the business and reinvest into the next investments. And the capital that we take onto our cap table, into our balance sheet is our long-term bet on these companies.
Yeah. And that earned equity, I mean, how much is?
1-3%.
Okay. And how do you decide on the interest rate and the equity? I mean, is deal by deal?
Deal by deal. At the moment, we've just started. Our MRR entry is if you're doing 50 grand a month,
yep,
we'd love to talk to you. But our first 2 investments are doing over 100 grand a month. So these are well-established companies doing millions of dollars in revenue, who are growing fast, who do want to do venture.
Yeah. Have you announced who they are?
Yeah, the first company is TeamGage.
Oh, great.
From South Australia.
Yeah, I knew that.
Friends of ours, now Will and Ben. And the second one is Creatively Squared from Brisbane. Coincidentally, both husband and wife founding teams. And we, these founders are very explicit in not wanting to do venture in the fact that they've had term sheets before.
Yeah.
And they said no. So they're very, they're deliberate and they're ambitious and they're our kind of people.
And the team. So, I mean, you mentioned the 5 operators.
Yep.
I think you're bringing people on. Again, I know who it is, but I don't know whether you announced it. Like, can you talk about the team?
Sure can. So I'm the CEO. April is our general partner. Jody Imam is our COO.
Great. Yep. Yep.
Kirsty Grant and Lance Hodges in New Zealand. So Kirsty is the head of people at Aura.
Yep.
And Lance was head of product at Vend. So we have a team of product people, finance, customer success, customer support, and I don't know, whatever I do. Our chairman is also Darcy Norton, ex-Adventure Capital.
Oh, yeah.
And we're all at your disposal. So the way we onboard is we grab a couple of hours with the founding team of the investee company on a Zoom with all of us, and we just talk about the things that they're working on and what the roadmap looks like for the next 12 months. Each one of us grabs a hold of what we're good at, and we jump on board. So, we're working on the business. So, we've helped Creatively Squared hire their head of products. We've helped TeamGage, making some decisions around the thing that we find with these bootstrap founders. Quite often they work in isolation, they work in a bubble, and they're making great decisions, but they don't have anyone else to kind of bounce it off and validate. So, and they've tried quite often to have advisors that are on the venture side of things. And bootstrap founders and venture advisors really don't gel very well because you know, growth at all costs is not what these people are doing.
Yep.
You know, we talk to Noel very often, who's part of your summit club.
Yep.
And it's very different thought process when you're a bootstrap founder versus a venture-backed founder. So having people around you that appreciate the fact that's what we're doing is really key to this. And that's what we do. You know, we have one foot in venture camp. So we believe secure founders run better businesses. And they can do that one of three ways. They can run a profitable business. They can raise a round of venture if they want to. Some of these founders are not anti-venture at all. They're just like, not yet. Wait until we're not ready yet. Or they can sell their company and secure their own personal wealth. And I, you know, my long-term vision here is that angel investing is no longer a lonely place for people like me 8 years ago.
Yep.
Is that we have experienced, cashed up operator founders who want to help more. And, yeah, that's interesting. So, Tractor Ventures itself is a business. We, raised from 43 investors, of which most of them are, experienced bootstrap founders. So yep. They're there to help. Like, we have people who absolutely believe in what we do. Interesting enough, we also have venture debt people and venture capital people on our cap table because they also know that not every company is venture compatible. And, you know, our goal is to deploy 10 to 15 of these a year. And I reckon half of those deal flow will come from our cap table.
Yeah. Interesting. And are you still going to be angel investing though? I mean, is that part of the model?
We will. And you know, the only because that's something we do, I'll turn the volume down a bit on it. I think April might turn up a little bit and I'll turn mine down just because my cap table is terrifying. You know, if we've raised, you know, millions of dollars from people I absolutely respect and I'm a brand new CEO, I've got a bank account full of money and a lot of expectation on my shoulders. And I'm excited. And, because of the team is just amazing. The founders have already got are amazing. You know, the people that are coming across our radar are very exciting. But there's a lot of expectation built in there.
But is it a zero-sum game? I mean, I think you said something before. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was kind of venture or tractor. I mean, can you not do both? I mean, is there not a model?
No, you can do both.
That?
Two things. You know, my data point, my strong data point of why I built Tractor was one of my early investment companies called Buildkite. So Buildkite was, you know, a couple of technical mates of mine worked at Pin Payments and Envato and had a side hustle that helped software developers deploy their software better. You know, they solved a problem for Envato. Envato were getting a little worried about shipping all their code and their intellectual property off to a third party to run all the tests and deploy it. So the founder of Envato said to the team, like, we can't do this anymore. And Keith solved the problem in a very, very good way. And they came up to me and said, Matt, you know, you're a business guy. Like, how do we turn this into a business? And, you know, at that point in time, they were doing $3,000 a month in revenue. So we raised a couple of $100,000 on a couple of mil valuation and they were profitable. Like, that's where those dividends came from you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
You know, we did a big secondary round at a couple of $100 million in valuation and nothing in between.
Great story.
And the point being is that was two things. It was founders saying, we're not running a startup here. We're running a business that happens to be a technology business. You know, all we care about is solving our problems for our customers, charging them good money because it's creating a lot of value for them. And I remember sitting in a boardroom just like this, pitching our early investors. The whole round took 3 days. And Tim, the co-founder, saying, we don't intend to raise again. With this money plus an R&D tax return, our goal is to get this company to sustain our salaries. They took a bit of a bath, like took a pretty significant bath on their salaries coming out of high growth scale up companies.
No, I'm sure.
But the point being is that they got it to the point where they brought the revenue, they brought the revenue up to the costs within a year. You know, it continued to grow. They hired their first employee after a year and a bit. You know, that employee was able to go and buy a house on the back of these secondaries. You know, like that. It's just such a good mechanism to keep in control and not have to take those new people in. And I tell you what, when you're negotiating from a position of that bank account has millions of dollars in it and it goes up every month, not down, the terms you take are very different to the terms you take when you're like, I've got 3 months worth of runway left. Can I please have some money?
Look, that's awesome. Look, and congrats on it. It's amazing. And I think that team you've assembled is brilliant. So, I mean, Jodie, actually did some work with Innovation Bay probably 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm a huge fan of hers and she was running, Springboard.
Yep.
I almost got that wrong. So yeah, great talent in that team. So congrats. I wanted to touch on a couple of other things that time's marching on here. So StartMate, StartMate 10 years, this year, I think. You're a partner there. So what does that mean? And give us your impression of StartMate.
Yeah. So, I got involved with StartMate when I was, working with Blackbird. You know, we were writing some checks together and, you know, they approached me and asked me some help in Melbourne. So there was no Melbourne presence for Blackbird or StartMate back then. 2017, I'm going to say. And then when, they hired Nick Crocker, we sort of had a Melbourne cohort. They were like, well, you know, we now have Melbourne presence. So why don't you, you know, come and do StartMate? So we did. And ultimately it's a mentor led accelerator. So I just do the things I do. So partner is at one point in time, there was some, you know, absolute partners. I think partners kind of float on a cohort by cohort basis now. But for me, I guess I just lent in. And our time at Amazon, you know, one of my jobs was accelerator BD. You know, my job was to make sure StartMate and the top accelerators in the country were looked after. So it was easy for me to be pretty impactful on those businesses when my job was to go and hang out with them and make sure they had everything they needed. And, you know, I'm sure Amazon wanted me to talk about cloud, but I talked about everything, including cloud. And it's, there seems to be a correlation between the people with more time to spend with the cohort and, you know, the impact you can have. So it was nice to get paid Bezos bucks and be able to help out founders.
It was definitely a luxury of that job in that you and I both got to do scratch our itch. I mean, we basically tried to grow the ecosystem and we did it from a position of care and passion and we got paid well for it.
Yeah. It's the thing that I realized on the way out was, working at Amazon, when I left, there was just under 1 million employees. There's nothing I could do to move the needle at Amazon.
Yeah.
If I found the next 100 Atlassians, it wouldn't even touch the sides on the bottom line billing of AWS. It just wouldn't.
I think with 100, you might.
100, right? Call it 10. Yeah, okay. Right? 10 Atlassians. If I did that, I might be able to move the needle and impact, you know, Amazon. But what I could do is use that brand and use that leverage and use that, you know, the time that my boss, like yourself and Rachel gave me to, use that for the founders.
Yeah.
And, that's what got me out of bed every day. You know, if I thought about the former bit, I wouldn't get out of bed. If I got out the second bit, I'd leap out of bed.
But let's just jump back to StartMate. StartMate is without question, I think the best accelerator program, followed by Daylight. I mean, it's quite a long way ahead. And, you know, there has been a drop off of accelerators. I mean, Muradi's gone, Slingshot styled it down, Blue Chili's gone. I mean, there's a bunch that are no longer there.
Yeah.
I mean, you, as part of that, you're often voted the best mentor. I mean, so just give us a little more color around, why StartMate's the best and why you love it so much.
Yeah. I think it's, hanging out, there's two things. Like hanging out with founders is, you know, it's kind of in, you know, we talk about, you know, your zone of excellence and your zone of genius. Your zone of excellence is when you do stuff, but after a while, it's a bit of a grind for you. It's disappointing for other people when you stop doing it. So, you know, when I left Amazon, people were like, why the hell are you leaving? You're obviously really good at it. I'm like, yeah, but it's a bit of a grind when, you know, I sort of, your zone of genius is when you do stuff and it doesn't even, you don't even think about it. The amount of people in the mentor list at StartMate that are in that, you know, they're able to help because they love it. It's impactful. It's not a grind.
Yeah.
Like that's a group of people that I enjoy hanging out with on the mentor side. On the founder side, I think we do a lot of work on helping the founders help themselves. You know, it's not a program. It's not like they're sitting in class and we're lecturing to them. So they're there. And some of them are a little bit confronted where they're like, oh, like you're not telling us what to do. And like, well, nobody tells you what to do. It's up to you to figure it out. But everybody within this group of people, the answers are there. So learning how to ask the questions and doing that in a way that is efficient is like, and watching over 12 weeks, people go from, I don't know what I'm doing. My goals are X to look what we did. Our goals that we set on day one have been like, they were way too small.
Yeah,
let's going. And, you know, it's inspiring to hang out with these people. So, you know, hang out with inspiring people, over-index on understanding what they need and see if you can help. I think that's probably why it ends up being getting voted that way a lot of the time.
Yeah, no, it's great. And look, and it's built itself into a self-sustaining, I think, profitable business. I mean, that, you know, and again, some of the paths they've taken, like with the foundation, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. Pretty genius. I mean, like, teach a bunch of people who want to get into startups. And
fellowship, yeah.
Fellowship, sorry. Yeah. Teach a bunch of people who want to get into startups and then charge essentially a recruitment fee. Mm. And it seems to be working. So, yeah, good on them. Interesting career path for you, you know, because I don't think you got a degree.
No.
Is that right? So no degree. You ended up in recruitment. You've mm-hmm. been a developer. I mean, so you've kind of followed this fairly alternative, career path. I mean, like, I think the last person interviewed before lockdown was Hannah Field from Tempest, yep. You know, so she had the recruitment background as well.
She worked with me.
That's right.
My bestie.
Yeah. So like, touch on that, like why recruitment and what's that enabled you? You know, what are the skills you've learned from that are good now?
Yeah. So, you know, you're 15 years as a self-taught software developer. Started off at a big agency called Hothouse here back in 1999, you know,
deploying
McDonald's.com.au and working on Olympics.com and Vodafone and all these, you know, masthead properties as a generally a team of three, like a project manager, a developer and a designer and building web apps or websites, you know, whatever they were, you know, back in the day. And that was really cool. Like third developer there ever, hired. I don't know why they hired me. I was self-taught. I was hacking on the web. You know, I did 3-inch computers for my HSC the very first time they ever introduced it. And my entire, you know, year was spent in the library on the internet building websites. And that was kind of it. So, you know, a software developer where, you know, software development taught me that you can solve these business problems and knowing how to do it from the ground up was really interesting. But back in those days, there wasn't a lot of content to learn from. There was a lot of viewing source and copying and pasting and figuring this stuff out. I learned quickly that I think about like the business stack right at the bottom is like software and servers and stuff. And up the top is strategy and business level stuff. And I, over the time, sort of went up the stack. So, you know, software developer, technical co-founder. So, you know, responsible for business stuff on the technology side of things and did that for a couple of times. And then, you know, flipped up into recruiting when I realized that I was kind of done. Like I'd got good enough. I'm not a craftsman. Like I'm not the eke out the last 2% to make myself the best of the best. That's not who I am. I'm a broad strokes kind of guy. And you'd know that having worked with me. And, you know, get the majority of the stuff done, get good enough so it's impactful, but not have to eke out the last little bit. So, I realized that, you know, it's better for me to bridge that technical business gap. And help other people, empower other developers to sort of get the actual detailed stuff done. And that worked pretty well. Flipping up to recruiting was like, I'm kind of done now. I'd spent a lot of time in the Ruby community, leading the meetups here in Sydney and Melbourne. When I moved to Melbourne to open up the Melbourne branch of Lookahead Search, I was the president of Ruby Australia at that time. Okay. So, you know, if you want to get a recruiter and you're hiring a bunch of Ruby devs and Ruby was the flavor of the time. So realestate.com.au and Envato and Redbubble and, you know, name all the really interesting companies now were Ruby shops back then. So, you know, it was a time when I was really happy to be helping because the common theme in my career is I enjoy empowering people and helping people. And it's not about me. Like, I'm a bass player and that's a pretty good way to think about what I do. Like I don't need to be front and center. It's just not who I am. I'd rather have other people out there doing that stuff. So as a recruiter, I was able to, you know, bridge that gap between understanding the business problem, geeking out with geeks, you know, and it ended up being like information arbitrage and sniping. It's like, I know that person over there and I know what they like. And I know you've come to me and you've got a job. Maybe I could just make that happen. And that was pretty successful.
Yeah. I want to jump onto the quickfire in a sec, but you mean maybe the last question for me. Like, I mean, you're relatively well known for wearing nothing but a blue baseball cap.
Well, other stuff and a blue baseball
cap. Oh, yeah.
The same.
No, nothing but, yeah, but the same one every day. And it's not even because you're going, I mean, I wear a baseball cap, but I'm losing my hair, so it kind of masks that. You've actually got a pretty thick head of hair under that.
I do.
And actually, it's not looking so blue today. It's like kind of off blue or gray. Yeah, has it just been in the sun too much?
It needs to be cycled. They're a consumable item.
Right.
You wash it once and they go a bit weird, so you got to buy another one.
Now, why is it? I mean, is it like Steve Jobs and his black turtleneck? You just don't want to have to think about it? Like, why do you love a blue baseball cap?
So I've worn a hat since I was a kid. Initially, it's because I had stupidly big hair. Like, I don't need to put something on top. But then it turns out that as a recruiter, it's very easy to say, just look for the guy in the blue cap, because I met new people all day long as a meeting new founders. You know, in pre-COVID land, you know, you're in a cafe and you're meeting someone for the first time. It's very easy to say, I'll be there with a blue cap with sunglasses on top, and they just walk in and sit down. You know, you'd have that awkward thing. So it was pure efficiency. I like to optimize for efficiency or effectiveness. So I think that was it. And now, you know, there was a few Zoom calls in COVID where it was downstairs and I forgot to put it on, and people were like, who's that weird guy? And I did grow a significant beard, and I let myself go in COVID, and I have a huge afro. So got rid of that again. It's not a good look.
Yeah, the beard's tidied up.
Yeah, the beard's a bit tighter now.
You're not quite ZZ talk. A little bit of grey coming through there, though.
That's wisdom, that Ian. That's wisdom.
Is it? Yeah. I can't even grow a beard, so it's pathetic. Yeah, my hair's falling out. I can't grow a beard.
Yeah, you better put a hat on.
What sort of man am I? All right, look, Matt, that was awesome. A lot of that I knew because we have been hanging out together, but there's always stuff that I pick up on and learn from. So hopefully there's been some nuggets in there for our audience. So let's see if we can get some more nuggets, the quick fire questions. So let's run through them. So any book recommendations?
Yeah, it's actually a really short management book. It's called Turn the Ship Around. It's about a Navy captain in the US who took the worst performing nuclear submarine to the best in a year. And it's all about how he changed the way the conversation, the language he used with his team, to intent-based conversation. And I love it because it's not about command and control. The only thing he ended up having to do himself was if they were going to launch the nukes. Everything else could be done throughout the team. And I'm learning, especially at Traktor, having a highly professional, experienced team of senior people around is just the way I do stuff. It's all, for me, it's all about removing the things I don't want to do and empowering other people to do them. And this book has helped me do that.
That's awesome. It sounded a bit scary, a badly performing nuclear sub. How do you measure
it? Well, I don't know, but the Navy has ways to do it. Read the book. It's very short. You know, and take you a couple of hours.
Podcast.
Yeah, there's a podcast that I was just reminding myself of the name of it, but it's called Out of Beta.
Okay.
And it's actually hosted by one of my portfolio company founders called Matt Wensing from Summit. And they're building two startups, and they just talk about it in direct and open about the trials and tribulations of building these startups. So it's called Out of Beta by Matt and Peter. They were part of the Tiny Seed remote accelerator, and they're building these products going forward. So it's quite interesting for people that like bootstrap founders and people that like, you know, people that are not necessarily taking the venture path.
Yeah.
Good insight into that.
And what did COVID do for your podcast listening habits?
It increased them when I was out exercising, but you know, just sitting on the couch listening to a podcast is an odd, like nobody does that. Who does that? It increased my solitaire time. So if I'm listening to a podcast, I'll play solitaire on my phone at the same time. So you get your iOS report and like, oh, I played a lot of solitaire.
I didn't even know solitaire. I guess it's just in the App Store. It's not built in.
It's a card game.
News source. What do you lean on for your updates?
I was thinking about this the other day. So the times when I felt like I leveled up as an adult is when I bought an AFR subscription. You know, it's important, you know, the people in the AFR, you know, write about important things. A lot of it's relevant to us. You know, I have a broad business, interest. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in there. You know, it's local to us. I have obviously, you know, read a lot of TechCrunch stuff, but you know, as I have a foot in both venture and non-venture camp, TechCrunch is becoming slightly less relevant to me, and I'm trying to understand other stuff. But yeah, AFR is where I get a lot of my news from.
Yeah, look, I've got to say, I signed up about 6 months ago, finally.
Yeah.
You know, because
it's not cheap.
It's not cheap. But it's great. I mean, I think especially, you know, Paul, Yolanda and Michael, you know, there's a few guys, folk in the tech journalist side that do a really good job. So, that's a good recommendation. Your favorite tech CEO?
Yeah, there's, it's two of them. It's Mike and Scott. I know Mike a little bit, and, you know, Scott, I spend a lot of time, with Kim, Scott's wife at Skip. And I just, you know, just great people. You know, the diverse interests, the empowerment of their team, the seems to have their egos checked, engaging. You know, that I think as CEOs, you want to be accessible. you know, to most, if not all people. I know it's hard, especially when you're running multi-billion dollar companies, but there's something aspirational about those guys. And slightly younger than me, which is, you know, new too.
Amazing.
But just good dudes.
Yeah. And I find it astonishing with those two that they have scaled at the same pace, you know, so they've gone from, you know, being uni mates in their garage or whatever it was coding to being, you know, titans of a $60 billion tech company.
Also, you know, plays into the Tractor thesis of, you know, secure founders run better businesses. When Excel came along and did an entire secondary round, you better bet you can make a big business once you don't have to worry about feeding the family.
That's right. Yeah, no, this is such a great point. Although I suspect even by that point, they were not worried about feeding the family.
Yeah, but I mean, like there's a point where, I mean, even if that was happened at a slightly earlier stage, there's a point where you go, now, you know, I'm not at risk. You know, my risk has been mitigated enough for me to have a proper swing at this thing. And I think if we did that a little earlier, my long-term hypothesis, if I do that a little earlier, we're going to make some big business.
Yeah, that's a good point. Favorite app?
At Tractor, I'm using Slack in anger for the first time. Like they've all been sort of like casual, you know, social things now. But now it's actually really good. You know, we're allowing us to have focused conversations on the desktop. I use Mailplane, which has got three or four Google accounts, and I can all have them in one thing, and it's not in my browser. So
okay,
a lot of time.
So Mailplane email.
Yeah.
Right.
The other one I'll mention is the same app that Matt on the podcast is called Summit. It's a forecasting application. So I don't use Excel for forecasting anymore. I build all my models in there.
Okay.
Very, very cool. Use summit.com.
So this is leading into the next question, which is productivity tool. Is that the same answer?
That's what I did. Damn it. I jumped questions. That was my same answer.
Yeah. Well, but what do you do for fun? You've mentioned solitaire.
No, yeah. No, what I do for fun. So I ride my, I got an electric mountain bike. So I enjoy going very quickly on that and up and down hills. So that's fun. You know, hang out with April a lot. You know, we spent, you know, in COVID, we were jammed together for 9 months, but we still managed to go for walks and explore our neighborhood and, you know, get our takeaway coffee. And it was kind of really simple and quite delightful.
Yeah, good on you. Last question. TV show. Do you watch TV? If so, what do you watch?
Yeah, lots of TV shows. My favorite, our favorite series is The West Wing. It's obviously a fantasy, but it's a fantasy that, you know, that we've been, you know, part of for a long time. It's that goes down as our favorite. You know, just I think there's a little bit of a movement against, you know, intellectual sort of conversations, and it's a little bit sad. So I enjoy that.
Yeah. And finally, I said it was the last question, but it's not. If you were asked to do a TED talk, what would you talk about?
I think I'd talk about the balance between having founders hungry and starving. I think I believe, you know, the de-risking of things allows people to make changes the way they make decisions. So decision making based on your personal risk profile.
Yeah, that's great. And where can people find you? So if they want to find out more about Tractor Ventures or you, like what do they do?
Yep. So Matt Allen on Twitter and tractorventures.com.
All right. Look, Matt, that's been great. I think we'll get in under the hour, so we might call it there. So look, thank you so much. It's always good to hang out.
Thanks for having me.
And then we're both off to lunch at Tech 23.
Yep.
So let's get on with it.
Thanks, mate.